James and Jason McKittrick, brought to you by CryptoCurium.
Good evening and welcome to another edition of Learning Lovecraft. I'm your host, Jason McKittrick, and joining me is my co-host, Ken James.
Hello, folks.
And welcome.
Welcome.
Tonight we discuss, on our third episode, the short story Dagon by American author H.P. Lovecraft, the focus of this podcast, as you well know.
As you well know at this point.
Written in July of 1917, it's one of the first stories that Lovecraft wrote as an adult. First published in the November 1919 edition of The Vagrant, Dagon was later published in Weird Tales in October of 1923. It is considered by many to be one of Lovecraft's most forward-looking stories. So Dagon. It's kind of interesting, because talking about our last episode where we covered The Tomb, where you kind of went into this kind of story where it's this obsession with the past and this past individual.
But it's also surrounded in one little town, you know, in one area on the grounds of a... I guess a sprawling estate, sprawling manor with the woods around it.
Sure. And it kind of concerns itself with a lot of things that Lovecraft will have come up in his later tales.
Sure.
Specifically, the case of Charles Dexter Ward. Dagon is kind of like the prototype for some of his later stories as well. A little more of his mythos types tales. This is kind of like a prototype for The Call of Cthulhu and also a little bit of Shadow over Innsmouth. Now, even though you haven't read this story fully, maybe, you know, sitting down to read before, we have a history with the story.
We do have a history with this story. For those of you guys who don't know, we have another podcast, Other Dangers, and we've had the great Greg Oliver Bodine, actor of stage and...
And screen.
And he narrated a story. I did the soundscape for it and kind of try to make it come alive, but his words were enough. He killed it. It was episode 33 of Other Dangerous Podcast, if you want to go back and hear a telling of it. But one other thing that he did for us, even I just want to bring that up because it's the holiday season. Episode 14 of the podcast, he did another narration, which is The Festival by H.P. Lovecraft. And these were my kind of first, because I did, you know, I spent hours working on them. And I read this story, like I said, I read this story last night, and it was hard for me reading Dagon and not hearing Greg Oliver Bodine's voice in my head while I was reading them. And I'm sure when I get to the festival, it'll be the same. But he knocks it out of the park, and if you'd like to go over, head over to there and... Yeah, those 14 and 33, those are two H.P. Lovecraft stories that are awesome.
And it'll sweeten these releases a little bit more, because, you know, this will be dropping during the holiday season, and if you want to listen to the festival during the holiday season, I recommend it.
Yeah, I've been told by a couple people that are like, the first time it dropped, and I think it was like, what, 2 years ago now?
Something like that, yeah.
It was like, I listened to it 7 times that year, and he goes, now it's a tradition of mine. And I was like, wow.
That's awesome. It's a tradition of mine. I mean, well, we'll go into this when we cover that story, but I read the festival every Christmas Eve. And I also got to read it in the actual burying ground in Marblehead, Massachusetts, in December 3 years ago.
This is the man I'm sitting across from right now. And I'm, as I learn this, I'm in good hands. I see it that way.
So Dagon, God, I love this story. It's at the time modern. It took place. It's taking place during World War I, which when he wrote this was the U.S. had just entered the war, and it kind of deals with that. That unknown threat that can come out of this, that can come out of just anywhere and annihilate us just whenever.
Yeah, whenever it sees fit.
Yeah, it's, and I think it also deals with the idea that, like, knowledge itself can cause, like, insanity, right? So it's just the knowledge.
Yeah.
Now, you know, we'll break down the story itself, but even right in the beginning, he says, I'm writing this under an appreciable mental strain, since by tonight I shall be no more. You know, penniless and at the end of my supply of the drug which alone makes life endurable, I can bear the torture no longer and shall cast myself from this garret window into the squalid street below. So right off the bat, it's
You lose. Right,
yeah,
off the bat.
I mean, it's already, look, it's over, it's done. But I have to share this with somebody else, because whether the sharing of this knowledge helps him in some way, or, you know, maybe in writing this down, maybe he'll be like, maybe I'm not so crazy.
Right.
So yeah, that isn't the case.
Yeah,
but.
Right. And like, yeah, when I took that, when I first, I remember not just reading it, but when I was working on the narration, like, yeah, like the hopelessness of the opening is like, what am I in for?
Yeah.
And it sets you up for that whole, am I, like, you're like, do I even need to read this, you know, or thing? But then you're like, oh yeah, I do.
Well, it's a different experience, because what you were saying in the beginning, it's a different, you hear it and that's cool and doing a soundscape, but it's different when you sit there and you have to internalize the whole thing and read it, and like your theater of the mind takes over and you have to, you are the instrument that the story plays out through.
But with editing it with his words and then reading it last night, my mind, actually, you're right, absolutely, it went to different places, and I started visualizing things differently because I'm reading it. It's going through this engine over here, this whole computer, and it turned up some good results.
So the plot, it's the testament of this tortured, morphine-addicted man who relates an incident that occurred during his service as an officer during World War I. In the account, his cargo ship is captured by a German sea raider in, quote, one of the most open and least frequented parts of the broad Pacific. He loves those lonely stretches of sea.
He does.
He escapes on a lifeboat and drifts aimlessly south of the equator until he eventually finds himself stranded on a slimy expanse of hellish black mire, which extended about him in monotonous undulations as far as he could see.
Now, I loved his description, if I may. In that portion of him, like, he fashions himself on a food and water to survive for his escape, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then he's talking about the sun beating down on him. But there was one part where it really, my internal theater took over, when he's talking about when he first escapes and the stars.
Yeah.
And he's talking about seeing the stars out in this lonely, you know, like, he's just like, there's this moment of freedom where he's, like, appreciating, you know, the out there.
Yeah.
But it's going to turn really quickly, because then he has the desperation of being beaten under the sun and everything, but that the stars, like him talking about that, really resonated with me. And I'm sorry for that.
No, not an interruption at all. We want your input here. That's great, because it's almost like, you know, and I think there's another story where they have somewhat of a similar kind of passage, but it's like you're struck by some, you know, the expanse of the sea, but at the same time, it's like, wait, this is the expanse of the sea. It's just me out here.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's beautiful, but at the same time, the it's terribly beautiful.
Right.
I think would be a way to say it.
Yeah, so like at that point too, like, you could, you know, he was obviously, his ship was taken over, so he's a man of the sea at this point. He's a military man of the sea. Yeah. And like, he has that moment of like, this is my terrain, and then he looks up to appreciate the stars, so it's like happy.
Yep.
But that's all gonna, like I said, it's all gonna turn in, because he's finding peace out there, but what he's about to find here, that's like a weird turn. It's like,
He also, and there's also a section where he describes the sky as so blue that it's black.
Yeah,
which is also like, wow. And then, like, I remember after I read that the first time, I remember like looking at the sky sometimes when you get those cloudless skies, when it's just that deep blue. It's like, oh, it kind of does.
Yeah.
It's like, gotta love Lovecraft. In a sunless sky that most people would look at and be like, oh, it's gorgeous, he's like, no, there's dread in here. This is you know?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So anyway, the region was putrid with the carcasses of decaying fish and less describable things. Love that. Less describable things.
Less describable things.
What does that mean?
You tell me.
No, that's what, I'm just posing the question.
I know.
Which he saw protruding from the nasty mud of the unending plain. So he theorizes that this area was formerly a portion of the ocean floor thrown to the surface by volcanic activity.
Right. So that, right? Mm-hmm. So that there, it's like, is this his theory, or is that what it is? Or did he just drift somewhere where this exists?
It's like, whatever you think.
I know, but like,
both are true.
I know. Both are true. Right. Let me bring it back down. Because, when I was sitting there, I was like, because the description of it, it's like,
Yeah.
It broke off from volcanic stuff, and the heat and its buoyancy of the mass of it rose.
And or there could have just been like an amazing, you know, cataclysmic event underneath that all this magma came up, so anything that was on the bottom floor just pushed it all the way up. It's not floating, maybe, it's just, it's pushed to the top. And then he also says, exposing regions for which for innumerable millions of years had lain hidden under unfathomable watery depths.
Well, unfathomable.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. It's you can't grasp it. It's that, once again, Lovecraft, and we'll see this with this story, this kind of like starts this off. Deep time is something that we're going to encounter quite a bit.
I think that too there was kind of also to counteract his happiness to see space and stars.
Yeah.
And now it's like, but it, on our own planet, it's unfathomable, the depths.
Yeah.
So like it's, once again, that...
Yeah.
That, like, he's finding peace in the unknown out there in the stars, but now it's terrifying that he's here and it's there.
Sure.
You know? I don't know how better to articulate that.
No, I get you. But then also you could think of also that, like, it's he was contemplating the stars, but then this landmass comes up, and it's like, well, this is on our planet, and this is unfathomable. So out there, what is that by comparison? If this is unfathomable, what is that out there?
Yeah. Yeah, well, and he hadn't gone back to that. Yeah, he hadn't gone back to that because, you know, once he gets to this place, it's like, it's all terror.
Yeah.
Like, once he gets to the surviving, right, of being on this vessel that he managed to break away from his captors, and he even said they were treating us good.
Mm-hmm.
As they would.
They were kind of lax, they said, you know, they were able to escape. Yeah, exactly.
And it's like, he finally has this moment of peace, and then it's just human horror at that point where he's like, oh man, I'm burning under the sun. I hope someone comes saves me.
Yep.
And then he lands to where what should be safety.
Right. Exactly. So after waiting the 3 days for the seafloor to dry out, when he comes to it, so he can walk on it, he ventures out on foot to find the sea, and possible rescue. After 2 days of walking, he reaches his goal, a hill which turns out to be a mound on the edge of this, quote, immeasurable pit or canyon. Right? So he makes this this allusion, isn't something like with hell, where it's like the depths where Lucifer is or Satan is, that it's like just this big, like, almost like cauldron that just goes down, right? Descending the slope, he sees a gigantic white stone object that he soon perceives to be a, quote, well-shaped monolith whose massive bulk had known workmanship and perhaps the worship of living and thinking creatures.
And that's... So, all right. So, once again, hearing it from when Greg was reading it and then me reading it again, I'm going back and I'm like, this is the stuff that I'm fascinated in. I've always been fascinated with is, like, these ancient writings of things that we even... You look at any kind of hieroglyph that doesn't understand.
Yeah.
But us as people, we're always like, you know, we have these scholars and people that are like, okay, this...
At least a human made it.
Exactly, right? And they attach it to the go, okay, this is human made, this is that.
Mm-hmm.
And at first he's like, you know, this is, you know, this must have been some ancient culture that is, you know, just some made up god. Some made up god of theirs, sure, while we have ours. But, and he's like, they're of hieroglyphics that I can't explain, right? And I'm sure World War I, it's those times there wasn't that much of an understanding. Right. But it's still, he's just like, then I see the creatures that are... Yeah, I'm sorry.
No, absolutely. You're right on.
It became so unsettling, like, I can deal with the...
Yeah.
The having to wait 3 days, he still has food, he still has water.
Yeah.
Right? Then he's like, oh, I can finally traverse on this terrain because it's dry now, so that leads credence to it was down there so long, and the sun did its work.
Right.
But then when he starts to see this monolith after, what did he call it? The hill? What did he... I forget the name that he called it.
But it was like a hummock?
Hummock, yes.
Yeah.
When he first sees the hummock, I'm like, hummock, but then when he starts telling it, context clues, I'm like, okay, it's like a hill, and he gets around there, and then when he sees the monolith, that's when the dread for me, reading it, I was like, oh, this ain't gonna be good, dog.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like, I was like,
exactly. So the monolith, situated next to a channel of water in the bottom of the chasm, is covered in unfamiliar hieroglyphs, quote, consisting for the most part of conventionalized aquatic symbols such as fishes, eels, octopuses, crustaceans, mollusks, whales, and the like. There are also crude sculptures depicting, quote, men, at least a certain sort of men, though the creatures were shown disporting like fishes in the waters of some marine grotto, or paying homage at some monolithic shrine which appeared to be under the waves as well. They were damnably human in general outline, despite webbed hands and feet, shockingly wide and flabby lips, glassy, bulging eyes, and other features less pleasant to recall. Curiously enough, they seem to have been chiseled badly out of proportion with their scenic background, for one of the creatures was shown in the act of killing a whale, represented as but little larger than himself. Oh yeah, it was a mistake, I'm sure.
Right, yeah, and but right there, once again, that description, that as that's like, you see a water creature in a movie, yeah, or horror movie,
yeah,
that's like, that's the image, right?
Yeah.
So like, at that point, you're like, that's good. So Jay just, on, while I was distracted, Jay just brought me over his version of the Idol of Dagon. Gang, get over to Katsukiri.
No plugs.
I know, it's me, it's not them, it's me. Yeah. I'm the guest here, I'm the one learning, sure, and I can say what I want.
Right.
But, so, that part of the story, I'm looking at this right here by Yoda. That part of the story, so when it gets to that, right, so that's where it starts unsettling me.
Okay, okay, yeah.
So I love where it's like, oh, there's, you know, he gives you that buildup of there's fish, crustaceans, mm-hmm, whales, other things, yeah, that are carved in this, and then, oh wait, there's this kind of man.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like a man. It's kind of their creature. And mm-hmm, they go, oh, then they had to do the one killing a whale. So it's like all the things, they're
yeah,
of proportion, but not, they're bigger because it has, yeah, to be on this monolith.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then it gets to the point where, and these are us.
Yeah.
And this is one of us killing a whale. And it's like, oh, that must be,
yeah,
crazy a proportion to see this thing. But mm-hmm, that description is like the description for if like a horror writer or a movie,
yeah, mm-hmm,
the lips, the whole thing, a sea creature, you go to Nightmare Before Christmas,
mm-hmm,
you make one crawl, yeah, Jack, you know, like that, yeah, that kind of description, like that's it, like,
yeah,
that's
a kill man. Well, this is kind of forward, like we said, this is kind of precursor to these are the descriptions, and they will go further when we come to the later stories, but this is the description of a deep one. Okay. One of Lovecraft's fictional races. This is a deep one.
Yeah.
And later on in Shadow over Innsmouth, we'll get more description on this, but apparently, according to, you know, the mythos lore, they're immortal, and the longer they live, the bigger they get. So they start out man size, and they just get bigger and bigger and bigger.
Okay, so this monolith, and I'm not, you know, we're obviously skipping ahead here.
Yeah.
But, so, okay, so that even makes more sense.
Yeah.
So he had this in the works, you know, he had this in the works.
Well, I don't, it's hard to say, because this was so much sooner than the writing of that story, because Shadow over Innsmouth was one of his later stories. We'll get to it, but he definitely had these ideas in sure, his head, for sure.
And it can make sense either way, just me when I was just describing the monolith of, mm-hmm, like, you know, all the kind of fishes and the sea life were in kind of the same size,
mm-hmm,
and the person, and then they had the whale. They also had the depiction of one of these men killing a whale.
Yeah.
So he didn't say it was odd, the size, until it got to,
right,
the killing of the whale.
Right.
So everything was just in proportion of, this is what they look,
yeah,
like.
Yeah, no, I gotcha.
This is what they are.
Yeah.
And that's when I was like, oof, this is...
Yeah.
Eesh.
Yeah.
This is...
Yeah. Like, there were limits in their ability to, you know, display it in a pictorial way,
yeah,
that they had to be like, okay, well, we got to show a killing a whale.
Yeah,
like, so almost like, know, in Egyptian hieroglyphs, where like the king is always showed bigger just because he's the king, but then the,
right,
queen is like this big,
yeah,
you know,
right,
like a couple,
yeah,
inches next to him. It's,
yeah,
just for, you know, artistic representation. Yeah, but I guess they were wrong.
Yeah.
So as he's studying this thing, something wacky happens. with only a slight churning to mark its rise to the surface, the thing slid into view above the dark waters. Vast, polyphemus-like, and loathsome, it darted like a stupendous monster of nightmares to the monolith, about which it flung its gigantic, scaly arms, the while it bowed its hideous head and gave vent to certain measured sounds. It's praying at the stone.
The terrifying part, too,
before or just by comparison, that's what it's doing, maybe.
Yes, right, but it's getting to it,
yeah,
right? It's getting to it. The darting and the churning, like, when, mm-hmm, it's like...
Yeah.
See, I'm starting with these kind of things. This is where I'm starting to get the concept of seeing something like this is maddening, right?
Yeah.
Because before that, you have something, like I said, the first one, the tomb, you have that.
Mm-hmm.
It's centralized, it's,
yeah,
like this...
Yeah.
It's a kind of almost a ghost story in a,
yeah,
way. It's like this, but this is... This is a beast of renown. It's something that is, he's stumbled upon mm-hmm. something that he can't fathom. Mm-hmm. And it comes out in the way it darts and moves, and then it latches yeah. on to the monolith.
Yeah. But then you say beast, but I think maybe not, because if it's coming out and it's bowing its head and giving certain measured sounds, it has a culture.
It's like a prayer. It's like
It has a culture. It has like, you know, so I think what you're saying is like what the horror is, aside from just seeing this thing, is that we're not the only one with a culture.
Right. It's
it has
a tradition. It has like a ritual of sort.
And what was it thinking? Like, is it like, okay, so this was thrown to the surface and this is clearly it's a religious object. It was looking for it and it found it.
Yeah.
Here it is.
Yeah, I hug it and I go, oh, thank you.
Maybe.
Thank you. Whatever I found you.
Thank Cthulhu.
Yeah.
yeah. Well, we'll get into that.
Yeah. Sure.
So horrified, the sailor flees back to his stranded boat and vaguely recalls a great storm. Then his next memory is of a San Francisco hospital where he's taken after being rescued in the ocean by a U.S. ship. There are no reports of any of these, you know, land upheavals, nothing. He doesn't expect anyone to believe his incredible story. He mentions one aborted attempt to gain understanding of the experience. He says, "Once I sought out a celebrated ethnologist and amused him with peculiar questions regarding the ancient Philistine legend of Dagon, the fish god, but soon perceiving that he was hopelessly conventional, I did not press my inquiries."
I love that. Hopelessly conventional. So, like, we all know that person. Like, me and you, we ghost story. And people were like, nah, your colon's okay. You know, like that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But before that, him from seeing that fling get back to the boat, he says, I was laughing a lot and I was singing to myself.
Yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. And those coping mechanisms for that writing to put in there, I was very for lack of a better word, drawn in, because that would be something I would do. That's something I do, and I'm sure people do when they're faced with something they can't deal with.
No, I think he says, "I believe I sang a great deal and laughed oddly when I was unable to sing."
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So it's like that portion in there. It's not just like, you know, relating to humans and this mm-hmm. and that. It's such a well-timed tool, I find, as a writer, to like have people question sanity, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And you put it into the part where he was away from the madness, on the way to safety.
Yeah.
So in between there, like the insanity that kind of that we do to cope, right? Like we turn into this like muddling, I have to keep walking, but this is going to keep me walking.
Yeah, like whistling against the dark, I think they call it. Yeah.
Right. And it was just, I was like, this is what would probably happen.
Oh yeah, no, and I also like the idea here in that passage where he searches out this ethnologist, and you know he probably came to him in a way of almost like, so there's these stories of Dagon, the Philistine god. Is there any like maybe fact or any like, you know, any you know eyewitness account? I'm sure he was like that. Yeah. Like I was like, no.
Yeah. Or the doctor was just like, I don't know what you're talking about. What? Dagon? What? No.
Well, I'm sure he heard of that. I mean, it's, you know, Dagon's in the Bible. They talk about Dagon.
Sure, but in the same breath, who's to say this doctor was, you know, he's a man of medicine. He's a man of science.
Yeah.
Those men in those times were the ones that were like, no, I'm a doctor. My whole focus is this learning of the human body. You're bringing up these tales of, you know, scripture, whatever it may be.
Yeah.
And all these different things. Biblical, what have you.
Yeah.
And he's just like, no, I'm just so not in that realm that you're mad.
Right.
This is madness. Sure. You're talking madness to me.
Yeah.
We'll give you something. You know, we'll give you some morphine. You'll shut up. And I'll go take care of the next crazy guy in the next room.
Yeah. Or maybe he got the morphine himself because, you know, the doctors were just like, you know.
The morphine's in the cabinet. Yeah. You know.
No, I mean just like maybe he got it, you know, illicitly. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Like he's just like, you know, and he's removed himself. He's in this room wherever this is happening. Maybe, you know, I guess this is
San Francisco.
So in once again in S.T. Joshi's I Am Providence, I found an insight that he made kind of interesting, where he says, Dagon is remarkable merely for its contrast in tone, theme, and setting from The Tomb, which we discussed last time.
Right.
Lovecraft, the 18th century fossil, has found inspiration in the great cataclysm, World War I, going on across the sea, and it is perhaps no accident that the story was written only a month or two after American forces actually entered the conflict. So I think that's interesting, because it's like, that must have been in his mind that, like, you know, now we're at war. It was the Great War. Nothing was like this before. Right. And
they're going to traverse these different foreign lands.
Yeah.
And you might stumble upon something, right?
Stumble upon something, or something can just come out of nowhere that just blows your whole conception of whatever. And, you know, it was that this, like this, we said in the intro, it's certainly a forward-thinking story, because it's like, because people came back from that war completely just because it was nothing that anyone ever seen.
Shell shock. Yeah, shell shock. That's where it came from. Yeah.
So, yeah, people saw unutterable horrors there, but like, you know, it's kind of crazy that Lovecraft was able to kind of like see that, like, there's going to be some stuff here that we're just not going to.
And he didn't serve, right? He, you know, no. Exactly. So, like, at that point, he had. It's so cool that, like, he had, he was like, and it was at the time, he was like, oh, I'm going to write this, and, like, I'm going to inject some of my stuff into this war, right?
Sure.
Like,
yeah.
I don't mean to be that insensitive, like, you know, any good writer or anything, you take what's going on at the time, and you put your spin, your take, whatever.
Oh, yeah, and this was going into his worldview to begin with, because he thought that the West was in decline, and this was, he probably saw this as, oh, this is probably the end.
And then he was just thinking about people out there on the sea.
Yeah.
What are they going to find? They're going places that, like, with more technology than they've ever had, right?
Uh-huh.
World War I. You know, they have people that are so good at, like, traversing the sea, but there's unexplored terrain.
Mm-hmm.
They may stumble upon something, and he let his head just...
Man. Yeah. Absolutely. And, of course, we have... this will become another Lovecraftian trope. He's haunted by the visions of the creature, quote, especially when the moon is gibbous and waning. Love it. He describes his fears for the future of humanity. And this is the quote, man. I cannot think of the deep sea without shuddering at the nameless things that may at this very moment be crawling and floundering on its slimy bed, worshipping their ancient stone idols and carving their own detestable likenesses on submarine obelisks of water-soaked granite. I dream of a day when they may rise above the billows to drag down in their reeking talons the remnants of puny, war-exhausted mankind, of a day when the land shall sink and the dark ocean floor shall ascend amidst universal pandemonium.
So, let me just say, as, you know, once again, a first-timer, I've read a lot of Poe, I've read a lot of Stephen King, that kind of diction...
Yeah.
It's so, I don't even want to say archaic. It's so, like, descriptive and, like, it almost, in a way, it's like, that's how words should be, if that makes sense. For me, it's just, like, that heavily descriptiveness, and it's also, it carries weight, right? Yeah. And talking about the ocean floor in that way, and what will come.
Yeah.
And the thought of that, you know that it was him...
Yep.
Expressing his concerns of what's really down there.
Mm-hmm.
We hadn't been to the moon yet. We haven't been, you know, and no, we haven't even been, you know, Jacques Cousteau So, like, at that point, it's like, man, he really thought about this stuff, and you know, no one was. People weren't really thinking about that kind of stuff.
No.
World War II is going, or World War I is going on, right?
God, and World War I didn't even know about World War II.
Yeah, Jesus. Right. I'm sorry for even... But, like, the thing is, it's like, World War I's going on. This man...
Yeah.
He's thinking about... He's fathoming the depths, you know, the fathoms of what's down there. And God bless him, because I'll tell you what. If I was... It'd put me back then, and I'm, like, thinking about that stuff. It'd be me talking about space or thinking about space. And it's... How articulate a person, just like that whole paragraph there. It's a man's concern, right?
Okay.
And the way he wrote it is so it's hard to express concern to other people about what you're really scared about, mm-hmm. especially when you're really scared about something.
Yeah.
Like, if I'm telling you about something that's going on, I'm like, no, look, there's this thing.
Oh, yeah, you just become a gibbering madman.
Yeah, right. But him to put it that way,
yeah.
And especially because it's fiction and stuff, but that was thought.
Oh, yeah.
That was, like, an actual fear, because...
Yeah. Well, a quote that more succinctly puts it is another quote from Lovecraft where he says, and this is at the center of all of his stuff, is, "The oldest and strongest emotion of mankind is fear, and the oldest and strongest kind of fear is fear of the unknown." It's this.
Yeah. So, and that's the thing, right? So if we put ourselves back there when we're reading that,
yeah,
so much is unknown. Modern everything, they go, "We know everything." That's what we live with now, right?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
"We know everything. You're an idiot if you question it." And fuck you, we don't. I'm sorry, once again, I dropped my second F-bomb here. But we don't. And it's refreshing to get into a story where someone's like not going, "The science of the day says," and this and that. Mm-hmm. Because once again, it's almost I'm not looking for a book or a fiction story that gives me too much of what the modern science is.
Yeah.
No, I love the fiction and the horror of the unknown.
Yeah.
And this is the gambit. Like, this is like the horror unknown of this creature and this guy. Yeah, he's crazy somewhere, but he went crazy because he landed on this.
Yeah, the knowledge drove him crazy.
Yeah,
it was
right.
So far outside of his conception.
And everyone's like, "God, we got to go deal with with your boy."
Yeah.
You know, the soldier in the room.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, it's good. It's really good. And just the concept of being adrift, right?
Yeah.
And landing upon this thing that shook loose. Maybe he said from some volcanic activity, but it could have been the war. Something torpedoes. Something could have.
Yeah, it could all be. It could all be metaphorical too. Aren't we all adrift? What if we land upon this thing that seems like a good thing, and then we get there, and then there's more horror than we thought was even possible? Okay, well, that's no good. And then you got to turn another way and do something else.
Then you got to escape that.
And... Yeah. Horrors unending, and we're on story two.
Exactly. But before you continue, I just want to say it's like, it's rat. It's not like wrapping my mind around the concept. It's more of like someone putting it in a perspective that is not just interesting, but almost unending in your own conclusions.
Yeah.
And I'm sure I'm going to get a lot of that. But on this one, and the creature itself, right? Let's say this is just a creature feature. Right?
Okay,
Let's say this is just like we're focused on...
Yeah, Dagon.
Dagon, or the Gill Man, or whatever you want to call him.
Deep One.
Deep One.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that like one of the most terrifying things you could ever equate to?
Absolutely.
Like something that found its it's like this creature that found its monolith and you were present.
Yeah.
You're present when it found the thing it worships, and it's huge, it's fast.
Yeah.
And it's loud and it's scary.
Yeah.
And it comes up and no hero in this story. I'm out, dog.
Yeah.
I'm running back to my boat and
I'm going
back to the sea where I almost died.
Yeah,
I'd rather do that.
Yep, and it belongs to some culture that's completely unknown. It's completely inhuman. You know, you don't know what it is, and because it just does not fit into your conception that you had up until this point, this thing exists. And not only does it exist, it's probably one of many. This could be a juvenile.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. Yeah. And that's why it's hugging onto it so much.
Yeah.
Because it's away from its parents, because the land left it.
This could just be, one of the small star spawn of Cthulhu that's waiting for its lord and master to awaken when the stars are right. That's later. Anyway, you gotta love, I love the last line, because it kind of, like, it's that pulpy kind of, like, little, like, theatrical last line where he goes, "The end is near. I hear a noise at the door, as of some immense slippery body lumbering against it. It shall not find me. God, that hand. The window. And what a way to end it, because it's like, here you are. He has these somewhat conclusions like we're talking about. But you have to end this because this was in a pulp magazine.
Right.
You know, so like, so where do we go from here? And I actually like this a lot, because even this gives you more questions. So was the monster there?
Or was he hearing it? Right. So it's like, it's it's fit itself into this hallway, and that's why you hear the slippery lumbering against the door, and it's coming to get him.
Yeah.
But I love the window, because it's like, what do I do? He's like, the window.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, I forgot my plan. Yeah. You know, like my plan was, I already said I'm going to do this, so it's here, and the whole the window. Like, that was my plan. It being there drove him back into this kind of like, it was almost like pulling him back in there, and he had to remind himself what his mission was.
Yeah. And I think just the, because this is his suicide note essentially.
Yeah.
So he's writing this, and I think he gets to the point where he's like, he wrote it all out. He's back there because, you know, when you have, or someone who has these kind of issues, you're there essentially. Yeah. It's so ingrained in there, and it's so awful for you that like you're literally, you just relive that you're literally there.
Yeah.
And so in my you know, conclusion of it, it's that he's so in the story that he hears it coming after him.
Yeah.
He's like, oh yeah, that's right, I'm killing myself.
Yeah.
And he's so living it that he actually thinks that it's there against the door.
Right.
Because I think of that passage before where he talks about all these things that are less describable flopping around on the floor. Like,
well, what you're saying right there is perfect, because it gets to the point where, because he's describing his account, right?
Yeah.
And then he gets to the point where, like, even now I hear it.
Yeah.
You know, and he's like,
yeah.
You know, like that whole, like, it's there. And then it was just, like he was reliving it so much that he even brought it to where he was now.
Yes.
He brought it back. He brought the memory and the story so far back into his memory and to his present that it was there.
Yeah.
So his madness, he had to snap himself out of the madness that he experienced back into the madness of I have to kill myself.
Yeah.
So he had to snap from one madness to the other to end all of it.
Yes. And his only exit is oblivion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a brutal take on a creature feature. I'm going.
No, I like that, because I like your conclusion on that, because because I think a lot of before this, because, you know, once again, 1917 he was writing this, and this is still, let's be honest, folks, if you're listening to this, this is light years ahead of most other stuff that involves a fish creature.
Right.
Yeah, maybe, you know, Creature of the Black Lagoon, which came out, what was it, the 40s? They kind of get into some stuff, but like nobody's freaking out. Like, what the fuck is that? Yeah, nobody does what? Nobody, like, maybe the girl screams because you have to have the girl scream, but no one's like,
they go, what? Oh, they throw the hand over the forehead. And
there's a body.
Yeah.
but nobody has that moment where, like, what is this thing?
Yeah.
Nobody, like, and I, you know, that's the conception that I always really enjoy with these stories, where, like,
was this a popular story of the time, or did there you go. So no,
only after the fact.
Right, exactly. So at this point, he's doing all this work for people that are interested in it to kind of like go back and go,
and there were
that's good.
Yeah. Well, there were contemporaries that thought the story was kind of ridiculous, but then he, you know, it's just the way that it was. You know, people give things a hard time.
Sure, but I'm going to say for my personal enjoyment of mystery and horror and stuff, okay, you got a big monster, right? Scary.
Yeah.
Origin, unknown, monolith, hieroglyphics.
Yeah.
A history of something that is of unknown origin.
Yeah.
That's right up my wheelhouse. That's like something that I'm like, oh, this is so cool, because like the answers aren't there, and there's this big monster, and it's like, oh, it leads you to think, and like he lays it up for you to spike your own conclusions, right?
Sure.
So at that point, it's like, I think it's a great work. I'm like, I understand why folks back then were like, you know, like,
It's kind of funny
too,
because
fantastical.
He had it, wrote it in 1917, but it wasn't published until years later. And it's funny because Lovecraft showed Dagon to his friend and fellow author, Clark Ashton Smith, who in turn passed on to his friend, George Sterling. It's funny, Sterling, he liked the tale, but he thought the ending needing pepping up. He needed the ending, needed some pepping up.
Yeah, some pepping
and
up.
And he recommended that the monolith topple over and kill the monster. This piece of advice Lovecraft wrote in a letter makes me feel that poets should stick to their sonneteering.
Well, that's the thing. Right. So, like, here's why it's scary.
Yeah.
Because the monster's out there, and it's people are being, like...
That's just silly.
Right, but that's the thing. That's why I was saying,
yeah,
like, there are no heroes. When I mean, like, big heroes, yeah, like, fist fighting, you know,
yeah,
these creatures. It's, yeah, no, we're exploring, yeah, unknown cultures and unknown creatures and, yeah, unknown things,
yeah,
at which us as humans,
yeah,
we only have an understanding of,
yeah,
the dirt and the,
yeah,
area
we're up
around
here
us.
And they're like, oh, the land creatures are noisy right now.
Yeah,
probably about it.
I hate that idea. That the
oh, it's terrible.
Yeah,
it's, oh, it's terrible.
So bad.
No, that's yeah, terrible. also, Lovecraft was he did not anyone like because he would submit to these, you know, he would submit to these magazines and they would offer him, like, you know, oh, you got to take this out, you got to cut this down, you got like, and he would just be like, no,
yeah,
and like, mm-hmm, or. Apparently he would do the trick of, okay, I did the edits he asked for and just not even touch it. And they're like, yeah, yeah, great, put it there. Like, it's famous how they just do like hack jobs on his pieces. Apparently the same thing happened with that, The Mountains of Madness, but we'll get to that. I certainly like your conclusion on the this, you know, being like a creature feature. And like, yeah, it is kind of like that a bit, but like the madness is the real...
Yeah,
problem.
Yeah, because that's the end.
Yeah, that's
the end.
Yeah, not only are these things here, but
well,
like
it's the beginning and the end.
Sure,
right.
Not only are these things here on the earth with us, but we have no conception of them. They're clearly here and established, and probably way longer than us. And yeah, there's nothing we can do about it but go insane. Yeah.
And they obviously don't give a shit about what we're doing there, because you're standing there, you're watching it. It obviously sees you.
Yeah.
It found this monolith. I'm here. I'm home. Mm-hmm. Run along.
Yeah.
Go back to your boat. Get out of here.
Yeah. If it even thinks about it that much.
Yeah. It's like, well, I eat whale. I don't... You're... Yeah. What are you? You're a toothpick.
Yeah, exactly.
Oof, it's a great story. It's definitely a great story, and I'm glad that I had the introduction with Craig Oliver Bodine to get in there, but reading it myself, I was able to travel there.
Excellent. Yeah. Excellent. Yeah, so this story, Dagon, is considered the first of, and this is only after the fact, and we'll get into this, but this is the first tale in the Cthulhu mythos. Lovecraft never set out and said, I'm going to make the Cthulhu mythos. It's kind of like after the fact,
right,
later on down the thing. But this was the first time there was this sea creature god, Dagon, and then later on, he returns, at least in name, he's discussed further in The Shadow of Ridgemith.
Dagon comes back?
Well, you don't see him.
No, I'm saying the...
The character.
The character.
Oh, yeah.
The concept.
Yeah.
That's cool to know. I'm glad. Oh, yeah. Okay, cool.
Yep. So, it's interesting because further reading here, the creature that appears in the story is often identified with the deity, Dagon, but the creature is not identified by the name in the story, Dagon, and seems to be depicted as a typical member of his species, a worshiper rather than an object of worship. He's worshiping at the monolith. It's unlikely that Lovecraft identified Dagon to be the name used by the deity's non-human worshippers. When Lovecraft wanted to convey something like the indigenous name of one of the old ones, he coined some unpronounceable jumble. So I think they're just using this by... He was using it at the time as like...
This was a follower of Dagon.
Well, yes, but the name Dagon is almost just like... Well, this is kind of like a conception. Is this the guy is like thinking about it. Is this Dagon? Like, what is this thing? I've looked through all these books. I'm trying to figure my stuff out. The only thing I could come up with is I saw in the book there's this fish god called Dagon. Is that who this is? So that's kind of like what they're saying. Like, he probably thought of at this point. Like,
right. So, like, but maybe the species is Dagon, or they are offspring of Dagon?
Probably that. And that's for right now they're saying that. But later on, yes, later on you'll see that... Because in The Shadow of Rinsmith, you have Father Dagon and Mother Hydra, and they are both star spawn of Cthulhu. Yeah, it's fun, man.
Second story, man. This is my second.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's funny. You're in the second story, and like you have these two stories, the tomb and Dagon, yeah, and they kind of inform a lot of his other stories.
Yeah, I'm already spinning out. I'm throwing,
yeah.
I'm shooting webs out all over the place.
There it is. It's pointing out some of, you know, sometimes that this has appeared in some popular culture things that people, that folks may be, you know, familiar with. There's the Stuart Gordon film Dagon, which is actually just an adaptation of The Shadow of Innsmouth. It's
sure.
It's
not good.
It's not my favorite. it came out in 2001. It's you might have, you know what? Down the road, we'll have to do like a viewing.
Yeah, sure.
And
sure.
We'll have to talk about it because there's a lot of folks that like it, but it's Stuart Gordon, and you either like his stuff or you don't. And yep. So Dagon also appears in a bunch of other pop culture areas. I mean, there's video games. There's Dungeons and Dragons even has a Dagon, but it's hard to tell which is which because you have like the historical Dagon and, right. and things like that. But most recently, which I thought was kind of interesting, and if folks are listening to this have not seen it or know about it, there was a game called Dagon that was released in September of 2021 called Dagon, and it's a telling of the story, but it's like one of those walking simulators basically.
Sure.
And you do the story, and like they read the original text, and then you get to see all the nasty stuff that he describes.
Sure, that's like an indie game, right?
Yeah.
It's like
a... you can either it's free on Steam, I believe, but if you want to just watch it, you can literally just watch it on YouTube.
Yeah.
It's by Bit Golem, was the developer. Okay. And it's pretty great. I mean,
is
there's
it really?
Yeah. It's okay.
I'm going to have to sync that up with Greg Oliver Bodine's reading.
You know? No, it's pretty great. I mean, you know, it's an indie game, so there's a couple things here and there that could have used some polish, and I think a lot of the things are from where it's called open source. Is that what it is? Where they can take, there's definitely some open source things in there, and it's really cool for an indie thing that really just had a Steam release. It wasn't really like a thing, but if you're interested, you should check that out, because that's one of the finer things that have been put out lately. But yeah, so story number two in the bag, sir.
Yeah, I mean, like, what I was saying too, like, it's just, this is like, it was such a drastic change from the first two I read. Yeah. And like you were saying, these are kind of both the, you know, they send you on the path of what I will be reading and learning. And, from possible reincarnation to a giant creature and an entire culture of giant underwater gods, basically.
Yeah.
I'm in, you know? I'm in. And the writing on this one, I feel, is definitely scarier than the two. The two moments, like, he had that moment of levity, but this one, there's no levity. It's escape. The one moment of levity is just like, I'm free for now. I see the stars.
Right.
And then it just is horror and conclusion.
Yeah.
Self-conclusion.
Yeah.
And I'm here for it.
All right. Well, then, I guess that that concludes this episode of Learning Lovecraft. I've been Jason McKittrick.
And I've been Ken James.
And we'll see you on the other side of sleep.